May I speak in the name of God, the lover, the beloved, and the love sharer. Amen. You hypocrites. You know how to interpret the appearance of earth and sky. But why do you not know how to interpret the present time? A powerful accusation coming at the end of a difficult passage, for Luke 12:29-56 seems to fly in the face of our preferred image of Jesus as the advocate of peace. Within the overall context of his ministry, Jesus preaches a message of peace. But in Luke 12, he recognizes that peace is never peace at any price. Jesus is recognizing that conflict, which may even spur some to violence, is unavoidable. It is the outcome of the kingdom's coming. Jesus lived in a context that was riven by social and religious violence. And the question whether violence should be used as a tool to achieve social reform, let alone something that could aid in the coming of the kingdom, was a very poignant question for Jesus. As it was for Jesus, so it is for us. We too live in a world riven by conflict that feeds the cycle of violence. And the question remains, what is the appropriate Christian response when in the face of an endless social conflict, violence is increasingly taken by some as a justifiable option, while waving the Bible in one hand and the gun in the other? In Jesus' life, the teaching we detect has a complex interleaving of two strands. The strand of non-resistance interleaved with non-violence. These are the two forms of protest against systemic evil. Non-resistance not only rejects acts of violence, but also rejects confronting the perpetrators of violence, seeking solidarity with the victim and offering no defense, even if we ourselves become subjected to violence at the hands of others. Practitioners of the path of non-resistance seek to change the world around them through sacrificial example. By contrast, non-violence seeks to change the world through directly confronting the social evils of injustice and oppression. Non-violence is the demand for change through confrontation that stops short of resorting to violence to win the argument. And when faced with the prospect of violence, the path of non-violence merges into the path of non-resistance. And in the larger frame, we see these strands of non-resistance and non-violence as essential elements of the Christian path. Jesus' journey from death to new life shows God's ultimate path of non-resistance. The new thing that God does in Jesus is to bring about profound change through self-sacrifice. But in his teaching and his ministry, Jesus follows the path of non-violence. In his confrontation with the systemic evils of injustice and oppression, The meaning of Jesus' words in Luke 12 seem to be in conflict, seem to be that conflict is the inevitable outcome of the kingdom's coming. The kingdom's message of peace and love will also require a non-violent confrontation with systemic evil. For the kingdom's peace is not peace at any price. As Christians, we're called to engage in the conflicts of the present time while refuting the use of violence as an instrument for change. Violence takes many forms, which brings us to Jesus' stinging rebuke, "You hypocrites." We Christians are hypocrites when our pretense to peace and love is a fig leaf that conceals the violence we claim to reject. For instance, as a gay man, I experience it as the height of hypocrisy when the church teaches the members of the LGBT community are to be loved and welcomed, while denying us the same God-given rights to love and fulfillment enjoyed by heterosexual persons. Love the person, hate the sin, is a form of pseudo-acceptance that continues to give aid and comfort to the forces of homophobic violence. And today, August the 14th, is the commemoration of Jonathan Myrick Daniels, civil rights martyr, 1965. Now, when calendar commemorations coincide with a Sunday, they move to the nearest weekday. However, the theme of today's gospel and the words of Jesus seem to make it very appropriate to celebrate the memory of Jonathan Daniels today. Robert Tobin, the son of Bob and Maureen Tobin, parishioners here at St. Martin's, in his recently published book, Privilege and Prophecy, provides a narrative of the Episcopal Church's evolving identity through the social activism during the period 1945 to 1979. And drawing extensively on archival materials and periodicals from multiple sources, he provides an intimate picture of how Episcopal leaders understood their roles and their responsibilities during a time of upheaval in American religious and political life. He places Jonathan Daniels against a background of Northern white Christian hypocrisy in the civil rights era. Tobin notes, white liberal romantic identification with Southern black suffering is an avoidance of the violence of racial discrimination on their own doorsteps. So much Northern white Christian advocacy for racial equality was conducted from the safety and protection of the position of white privilege. John Butler, a prominent Episcopal churchman of the time, noted, "Demonstrating publicly in the South had required less personal courage than confronting the genteel racism of his parishioners while a rector in Princeton, New Jersey." And Tobin cites the great William Stringfellow, who commented that they, Northern white liberals, do not despise or hate Negroes, but they also do not know that paternalism and condescension are forms of alienation as much as enmity. You hypocrites, You know how to interpret the appearance of earth and sky, but why do you not know how to interpret the present time? Jonathan Daniels was a young Episcopal seminarian at Harvard's Episcopal Theological Seminary, struggling with the paradoxes and the ironies of his horror of racial oppression, but essentially from his position of white privilege. Like many others of his ilk, he joined the Selma March. But unlike many, he took to heart Stringfellow's rebuke. He not only marched, but also felt compelled to remain afterwards to register black voters, tutor children, and help integrate the local Episcopal Church. In so doing, he explained, "I could not stand by in benevolent dispassion any longer without compromising everything I know and love and value as the price that a Yankee Christian had better be prepared to pay if he goes to Alabama." And in mid-August 1965, Daniels was shot dead as he shielded a young black activist, Ruby Sales, from the deadly aim of Tom Coleman, an unpaid special deputy, who was subsequently acquitted on the grounds of self-defense by an all-white jury. John Coburn, who at the time was the dean of the Episcopal Theological Seminary, later confessed, "It took a long time to realize that John was a martyr. He was just a typical questioning, struggling student, trying to make sense out of the issues, conflicts and injustices of our society." And Tobin notes that over time, Daniels has come to be revered in the wider church as a Christian martyr who gave his life in the cause of human dignity. As Daniels explained, "I could not stand by in benevolent dispassion any longer without compromising everything I know and love and value as the price that a Yankee Christian had better be prepared to pay if he goes to Alabama." And in the memory of Jonathan Daniels, we can see the interleaving of Christian non-resistance with non-violence. Daniels embraced nonviolent protest in the face of the evils of racism and accepted the ultimacy of non-resistance because he had come to the realization that his possible death was the price that as a northern white Christian he had better be prepared to pay if he goes to the South. And once again, our nation is embroiled in tumult and inflamed hatred, manufactured grievance. The abolition of slavery, the emancipation of women, the recognition of the varied and richly human experience of homosexuals are milestones in the achievement along the long road of conflict that is the march towards a future that is better than our past. For progressives like myself, I count these milestones as the signs of the kingdom's coming. But as Jesus so rightly recognized, not everyone does. Bringing urgent poignancy to his words, "Do you think that I have come to bring peace to the earth? No, I tell you, but rather division." While living through another period when five in one household will be divided, father against son, son against father, mother against daughter, daughter against mother, mother-in-law against daughter-in-law, daughter-in-law against mother-in-law. It is now imperative that we learn again how to interpret the present time. In his 1838 Young Men's Lyceum speech, in which he warned against mob violence and people who disrespected America's laws and courts, Abraham Lincoln said, "As a nation of freemen, we must live through all time or die by suicide." It is now imperative that we learn again how to interpret the present time. Amen.